Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is World Report. Good morning, I'm Marcia Young. The federal government says it will sell the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion once construction is complete, and that day is almost here. The project will begin moving oil in a few weeks, but as business reporter Kyle Bax tells us, the sale could be nearly as contentious as the pipeline itself.
There's no way anyone would pay the full cost of the pipeline.
Energy analyst Rory Johnson expects the federal government will have to take a financial hit. Ottawa bought the Trans Mountain project 6 years ago. The initial cost to expand the pipeline from Edmonton to the West Coast was $7.5 billion. It's since jumped to $34 billion. With construction complete, the federal government faces a decision of when to sell it, who gets to buy it, and for how much.
You're going to need to take a haircut of at least 50% of this pipeline.
The government could choose to delay until after the next election. Stephen Mason is with Project Reconciliation, an Indigenous-led group interested in purchasing the Trans Mountain project.
I'm not sure the Liberal government want to get into a public recognition of what the write-down is ahead of the election.
No matter the decision, it could impact how voters view the Liberal Party's handling of financial, economic, Indigenous, and environmental issues.
They are really on a hot spot. They weren't a hot spot when they bought it.
Danielle Belland is a political science professor at McGill University.
It will depend how much they can get for it, if they can find a buyer, and if it looks like a far sale.
The federal government has held informal talks with Indigenous communities and other potential buyers for several years, but a formal process has yet to begin. Kyle Bax, CBC News, Calgary.
Drivers in Ontario and Quebec are dealing with a big jump in gas prices this morning. Dan McTague, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, says there are three factors.
It's the perfect trifecta. Tensions in the Middle East, the carbon tax increase, and the switchover, which happens semi-annually from winter to summer gas.
In Ontario, gas went up by 14 cents to just under $1.80 a litre. And in Quebec, some prices are close to $1.90. Drivers have not had to pay that much for gas in the two provinces since August of 2022. Analysts say that, among other concerns, the rise in gas prices could drive up inflation just as the Bank of Canada is considering interest rate cuts. McTague says the situation in the Middle East could continue to cause more volatility in gas prices in the coming weeks. The G7 foreign ministers have a difficult task before them. They're meeting in Italy today, and they have to decide how to respond to Iran's direct attack on Israel over the weekend. Their response has to be strong enough to dissuade Israel from taking matters into its own hands, but it also has to be enforceable. Dominic Philaitis has more from London.
All right, coming.
Buenas tardes. I'm very happy. Happy to represent Canada.
As Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly meets with her G7 counterparts on the idyllic Italian island of Capri, the situation in the Middle East is topping the agenda. The G7 is considering imposing sanctions against Iran following its attack on Israel last weekend. It has Tehran's oil exports and the producers of its drones and missiles in its sights. But analysts say such a move could put the world's richest economies on a collision course with third countries, including China, which is Iran's biggest customer of its oil and involved in the supply chains which produce military technology. Hassan Al-Hassan is a senior fellow for Middle East policy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He told the BBC any sanctions the G7 do pass in Capri could be ignored.
The G7 has already had issues with getting countries in the global south to abide by and enforce sanctions on Russia, partly because of the perceived lack of legitimacy that these sanctions have in the global south. So I think we might be seeing, again, enforcement issues.
The European Union has already agreed to expand its sanctions on Iranian drone and missile producers. Western allies are hoping the new penalties will help limit any Israeli retaliation against Tehran for its unprecedented attack. Dominic Valaitis, CBC News, London.
Ukrainian officials are pushing the U.S. Congress to pass its stalled foreign aid bill. Denis Shmyhal is the Ukrainian prime minister. He told the BBC Russia must lose this war.
If Ukraine will fall, the global system of security will be destroyed. There will be many conflicts, many such kind of wars, and in the end of the day, it could lead to the Third World War.
Ukraine says it does not have enough weapons to shoot down all the missiles Russia is launching. At least 12 people were killed yesterday. The U.S. foreign aid bill includes $61 billion for Ukraine, but some Republicans say they will not support it until the government pledges more funding for U.S.-Mexico border security. Temperatures in West Africa's Sahel region are soaring. They are in the midst of unusually intense hot spells. A new report released this morning finds it is a result of human-caused climate change. The World Weather Attribution Analysis shows the burning of gas, oil, coal, and trees are culprits. Kiswandzida Gwema is a climate scientist with the Red Cross Climate Center. He contributed to the study.
There is a clear evidence that it is climate change that has led to the magnitude and the duration of this event.
Mali and Burkina Faso hit about 45 degrees Celsius between April 1st and the 5th. The region's hospitals and mortuaries were full with the injured and the dead. The world's largest democratic exercise is about to begin in India. Nearly a billion people will head to the polls starting tomorrow. They're electing their representatives in India's lower house of parliament, and voting will take 6 weeks to complete. Freelance reporter Priyata Bajbasi has more.
It's a mammoth election in the world's most populous nation. Voters will cast their ballot in seven phases across 1 million polling booths. 15 million polling staff and security personnel will be deployed. And all pre-election surveys predict a comfortable win for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party or the BJP. Some surveys put his approval ratings as high as 80%. Modi is telling voters, now more than ever before, the nation needs a strong leader like him.
At a time of global crisis, we need a stable government with full majority in India. A government that can make India a developed nation, one that can make India economically stable.
Two dozen rival parties have come together to take Modi on. They call themselves the India Alliance. But opposition parties are facing a spate of legal cases. They accuse Modi of cracking down on dissent ahead of the polls. Opposition leader Rahul Gandhi.
What sort of an election is this? Leaders are being threatened. State governments are made to fall by bribing leaders.
If Modi does win, he'll become only the second Indian leader in the country's history to win three back-to-back mandates. Priyata Brajbasi for CBC News, New Delhi.
Scientists around the world are working to address an emerging health crisis. Antimicrobial resistance happens when germs like bacteria and fungi build up resistance to drugs. It is of particular concern in the veterinary world. Research into this problem led to a friendship between two scientists in Saskatchewan. As Sam Sampson tells us, they continue to work together on opposite sides of the globe.
There is nothing as gratifying as when your student kind of surpasses you.
Joe Rubin sits in his University of Saskatchewan lab, where the professor of veterinary microbiology worked with his first graduate student, Roshan Madalagama.
Actually, he changed me, my life.
Madalagama is now back in Sri Lanka, but the two are still studying antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, together. That's the resistance to antibiotics that make healthcare harder and some treatments riskier. The World Health Organization deems AMR AMR a major global threat, and rates are especially high in Sri Lanka.
Now, all the world is like a one village, now global village.
Madalagama says his country has only monitored AMR in humans, not animals. The immediate worry is vets won't be able to treat illnesses in livestock, which many families depend on. And the big worry is that resistance to treatment could get passed on to humans everywhere.
So because of that, actually, we need to have a very collective effort.
Madalagama has helped the WHO and the Sri Lanka government on the issue, but now he and Ruben are also helping rural vets detect concerns faster and improve training at the country's National Veterinary Lab. Two technicians are even traveling to Saskatchewan this fall to learn more from Ruben, a person still close to Madalagama's heart.
I also always believe that my second home in Canada. As a mentor, he's one of the greatest person I ever met in my life.
A friendship sparked in Saskatchewan that could fight a global health threat. Sam Sampson, CBC News, Regina.
And that is the latest national and international news from World Report. News anytime, cbcnews.ca. I'm Marcia Young.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.